season 2, episode 2 of the Barefoot Pause podcast. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Stu. I'm your host. In today's episode, we are going to be talking about soul-crushing obedience. Let's define some terms. First, what is soul-crushing? Soul-crushing simply means that the pressure is so incredibly high on the performance stakes for your student that even though they might comply in certain situations, their compliance is really lacking in any zest. There's no enthusiasm, there's no effort. So when you actually need it, even though your rate of response is pretty good in certain situations, when you really truly need that emergency situation stuff, it's just not going to happen. Obedience is nothing more than a series of skills which we use in harmony with our student to be able to navigate situations as they occur in social situations. So, for example, those skills may be heal, walk with me and ignore that, recall, leave that, come to me, stay, wait there while I do this. So all of these skills that we are teaching our students are useful, they should be functional, they should be practical, and in my opinion, our students should be able to deliver those with enthusiasm and effort to be able to give you the execution that you need when you need it. So the question then becomes, are you killing it with obedience? Or are you killing them with obedience? If it's soul crushing, you're killing them. So why is it important for any performance to be carried out with as much enthusiasm as you possibly can get out of your student? We're going to talk about that soon. Let me set the scene for you. Recently, we're out and about and I saw this guy and he was working with two dogs off lead and I could see there were some struggles there, but I really wanted to see how it was going because one of his dogs actually started to look pretty good. So he had what turns out to be a soft border collie. This border collie would do anything that this guy would command his dog to do. He gave the dog a down signal, the dog immediately downed, he'd give the dog a stay signal, he walked away, he jogged away, he stood at a distance, using hand signals and all this lovely stuff. His rate of response from his student was really good. One command, one response, the correct response, and it happened every time. So you could be forgiven for assuming that, hey, this is great. Now, I don't know what this guy's journey is. I don't know what the dog's journey is. I don't get to judge. But what I do get to say is that although the rate of response was good, remember, one command, one correct response, there was no enthusiasm in what that student was able to show. So what that informs me is, as a careful watcher, as someone who has an eye for those details, when the border collie got up, I've seen how border collies can move. They're fast, and this dog was not fast. He moved like a Newfoundland, slow, ponderous, lethargic. There was no enthusiasm to know. The recall should be banging. It should be hot-footed. There should have been sand flying everywhere when this dog takes off. Couldn't see that with the border collie. When the student arrived at their owner, there was no kerfuffle. The reinforcement was expected to be internal. There was no external reinforcement of any quality. So why did it then work? Stu, if the student is able to do one response, one to one command, what's the problem with that? Well, here's the problem. One, we have a soft dog. The only reason why they're actually performing their skill set is because they are seeking to finish it off as quickly as possible with apprehension and with the fear of making a mistake. If they stuff it, bad things used to happen. That's what it looks like. Our student's performance is a direct, measurable metric for our relationship and our interaction with our dog. If our dogs are slow and ponderous and lethargic in coming to us, that indicates to anyone watching that the student doesn't seek your proximity on their own because they don't see you as someone who is intensely valuable. You don't have the balance in their account to be able to make withdrawals. You need to be making deposits. So as we're walking past, the other actor come into play. So that we've talked about the nervous/sad border collie. Very soft dog, very biddable, very easy to get what you want out of them. But then there was the smooth collie. Think of Lassie with a short haircut. This dog was the complete opposite of the border collie. This dog was hard. This dog was tough. This dog knew what they wanted and it was not in line with their owner. So when we were at the life-saving club, all you could hear was this manic barking going off every few minutes, and it was this smooth collie. And I thought, well, it's kind of annoying. It's kind of a nuisance situation. But eventually they took off and thought, nah, whatever. Then as we're coming up, I could see that the gentleman's working his border collie. Okay, sweet. I wonder what's going to happen with the smooth collie. And there was zero rate of response. There was an expectation placed upon the student by the owner, but there was no enthusiasm. So there was going to be no effort. So there was definitely not going to be any execution on behalf of this smooth collie. Now, why is it that two dogs show two very different responses to the same owner? Because what the owner was able to do with the border collie was pretty simple. You just pile the pressure on. The border collie is going to make up for your lack of fine motor application, and they will get the job done because they're a border collie. The smooth collie, however, is more of a case of, I've got you pegged. I don't need to do your job. I can take on whatever it is that you're going to put on me, and then I get to go and do what I want anyway. Because I'm tough, I'll just take it. That's the difference between a soft and a hard personality. On one side, we can take the pressure and I'll just wear it and I'll be done with it. On the other side, slight pressure, flatten. So pressure must be modulated. It must be regulated. It must be used wisely in order for our obedience to become expressive. There's no problems making this stuff an art form. You look at any competition and people are gunning for the minutest of points. They're trying to shave off fractions of a second and getting into a heel position. If you have a look at the SRV mock trial that I put together a little while ago, you can see that Coda flips in her down. She goes from a Sphinx position and as soon as I go out of sight, she flips her hips. I lost points for that. And if I really want to grind it down, I need to put pressure on in strategic ways to be able to ensure that Coda's Sphinx position stays the way I want it to stay, so that the performance maintains a certain amount of points in the trial world, or more generally speaking, that the performance maintains or enhances a level of enthusiasm or effort in whatever it is that you're doing. That is irrelevant. I'm hoping that you understand that pressure will diminish our enthusiasm, which will affect our effort, which will affect their execution. And if we're not careful how we regulate those things, we're going to end up in some pretty severe trouble later on down the track. Remember that I said that obedience should not be soul crushing. Obedience in an ideal world is going to be expressive for your student. When they're stoked, they're going to show it in their heel by prancing. When they're frightened, they're going to show it to you in the speed of the recall coming back to you, looking for you for their safe and protective person. That's the point of these obedience skills, is that we have an artificial skill set which we attach, we install that into our dog's operating system, so that not only do we have our individual dog and their genetic predisposition, not only do we have their breeding and what their breeding is able to show us, not only do we have the canine themselves, we have those three layers, all of which, relatively speaking, are pretty savage. Then we come along with our civilized skill set and we bolt those onto our individual dogs. Now, the point of that is that if I can get across that these are this obedience skill set or any other skills that you're looking at adding in, if I can make those expressive and put some enthusiasm into those, that when I need to call upon those artificial skills, that tiered selection of savage innate skills is overshadowed by the artificial skills that I've spent so much time investing in. Now, remember, I've said this before, to fully raise and train a dog, it's going to take 15 to 24 months. That's a lot of time for you to invest in this artificial skill set to be able to channel that innate skill set that they have and fuse that together into something that allows you to enjoy life with your dog, not enjoy life because of your dog. Big difference. If you want soul-crushing obedience, then you've got a competitive lifestyle between yourself and your dog, and that's not why we get them. You want a harmonious relationship, especially these days where we bring dogs into our lives because our kids are older now and they're doing their own thing. And gee, I just miss that toddler stage. I miss that young kid stage where we were everything. But then we bring a dog into our lives. We give them too much freedom. We don't teach them an artificial skill set. And now I just go straight to the teenage stuff that, gee, I'd forgotten about that. That actually sucks. On the flip side, we have the surrogate child, whether that's the nanny dog, whether that's the young couple that's gone out and they've gotten their dog to essentially practice being a parent on. No problems at all. One, treat them like a dog. Accept that there are these innate tiered skills, like this way of being. You have your individual dog who will express themselves in an individual way, confident, fearful. So if you've got a hound, prepared for them to be super independent. If you've got a retriever, prepare for them to be super dependent. If you've got a bully breed, prepare for them to want to go through a situation. Any situation. Is it 1+1? Smash. Is it a toddler? Smash. Is it a brick wall? Smash. That's what bullies do. Then flip that around to something like a border collie. 1+1? Run around, bark at it. Toddler, run around, bark at it. Brick wall, run around and bark at it. Okay? So you kind of get the picture that different breeds have different ways of expressing themselves in the same situation. But once we get too overwhelmed, then we lose a lot of the individual expression. We also start to really heavily dilute and then lose the breed expression. And what we end up with is a canine expression. And by that stage, like, we're in a pretty bad place. A lot of that is going to tend to be either predatory, defensive, or aggressive in nature somehow. What we want is for that artificial skill set to be overriding those three levels, so that at any moment in time, whether my student is having a good time or whether they're having a bad time, at any moment in time, I can say, you have to come over here. It's not up to them to kind of figure out and analyze, hey, why? Why? Because there's a bus coming. Why? Because you're in the middle of a whole bunch of jellyfish on the beach and you can't eat them. Why? Because there's a massive wave coming at the beach. Why? Because there's a cleaner coming with a really heavy piece of machinery and you've got to get out of the way. Why? Because I dropped the lead and you're now in the middle of the road. Why? Because you're playing with a dog and I'm late for my next appointment and you've got to come over here so we can get out. Why? Because there's another dog chasing you and you haven't seen them yet. The why is not important. What is important is that if we have built expressive skills, that artificial skill set, then we are redirecting either the excitement born of deficit or of benefit. That's irrelevant. The why is completely redundant. You say heel, your dog comes running over and flips into heel. You say come, the dog leaves whatever it is that they're doing, sits in front of you, paws up going, well, what's next? You say sit, they instantly sit going, this is a point of benefit for me. Your dog will do the things that they find to be most beneficial most of the time. To us, what they actually do might not make much sense, but the perception is that it is the best thing for them at that moment in time. And if I can override that savage nature, that fight and flight, the aggression, the reactivity, the anxiety, if I can override and teach an artificial lifestyle, then I'm ahead of the game already. So if we're now looking at this idea that the obedience that I'm teaching my student should be expressive in nature. Well, Stu, how can I make it soul-crushing? Okay, you can make it soul-crushing by having an imbalance between pressure and benefit, between pressure and enthusiasm, pressure and effort, pressure and execution. Let's talk about that pressure. Let's say, for example, that I am teaching my dog to heel and I reckon I can heel them for 10 paces. So I heal them for 10 paces and go, oh, that was pretty good. Let's just do another 10. And I'll do another 10. Then I'll do another 10. So now I've already done 30 paces while my student is able to do what it is that I want them to do. And then I just give them a scratch behind the ear and walk away. Well, that's a lot of effort. Very little payoff. The performance itself is not that reinforcing of its own. I need to apply an external reinforcer at least commensurate with the amount of effort that our students are putting in. Otherwise, what happens is the pressure outweighs the performance, and that means the performance is going to suck. Enthusiasm must outweigh pressure. Effort must be greater than the pressure that is applied through training, and the execution cannot be punishing. Remember that punishment is anything that reduces the intensity and or frequency of a behavior. So if my execution is such a grind, then the next time I want it, I'm going to get worse intensity, or it's not going to be as readily called upon before. And I've got to keep that in mind, because the only reason to ever train an obedience skill is to use it in a serious situation. I don't just simply say heal for the sake of it and then have my dog heal for half an hour. It's too much. Particularly when you start to tighten things down and you're using a lot of competitive sort of stuff, it's too much. You're cooking that brain. Half an hour healing is incredibly difficult. Don't let the performance be punishing. Enthusiasm must be greater than the pressure. Must be. Our effort must be greater, or our available effort must be greater than the performance demand. And the performance cannot be punishing. Remember that punishment is anything that reduces intensity and or frequency of a behavior. And if I make the performance punishing, then over time I am eroding the performance, thereby making the obedience skill soul crushing. So let's avoid the soul crushing nonsense. Let's actually talk about how can I avoid the soul crushing experience for my student. Stoked. That's the reason why you're hanging around here. So let's avoid this whole soul-crushing experience for our students and for us. It sucks. Why should we bother with it? So let's talk about how I can create expressive performance in my student. Rule one, build a TAM, a terminal appetitive marker. Pair what it is that your student likes. I always start with food. Pick their favorite food, pick their favorite foods. Go to the runway or any other drill to be able to charge up your TAM. Remember your TAM, your terminal appetitive marker, that's a clicker, that's a yes, it's a whistle, it can be a picture, it can be vibration collar, it could be stimulation on the neck from an e-collar, whatever it is that you're using that your dog can then connect to, hey, I just did something that made you predict you're going to pay me. Now, I feel like I'm in control. We can then flesh that out with a complete series of markers. What are markers? Markers are signals that we use to indicate to our dog a specific concept. So we can have yes, no, good, wrong, for example. Under the banner of yes, some people have very intricate systems. I just stick with a single TAM because that's what suits my particular purpose. Other people, especially competition people, will have a series of different TAMs. So they might have a TAM for take food from the front, take food from the left, take food from the right, take food from the back, take food from the back left, back right. And that allows you to then change the picture of certain things. So if you've got a dog that is healing really well, but they're forging ahead a little bit, I might just give them a TAM that says, hey, you're gonna get food from behind you, or hey, you're gonna have to get food from behind me. And that gets them to come back around and thereby creeping them back into position a little bit. And through reward placement, I can then start to get my student to understand some neutrality in the performance itself as far as their positioning goes. I can also have things for reinforcement from me, reinforcement away from me. So I can, for example, go, hey, here's food for me, throw the food or have the food hidden or already have the food placed down somewhere whilst I'm doing recall, for example. And then I can go, whatever, the signal is, and they can go off and get that food for themselves. For example, now here's where it gets really, really cool. If we dive into a little bit, and this is where the vast majority of soul-crushing events happen. The simple, easiest way to crush the soul of your student is to simply get the whole picture in front of them and say, do this. It's like giving a kid a 1,000 piece Lego kit with no pictures, no reference, and say, build it. I don't know. What's it supposed to look like? I don't know. I've got all of these pieces. I can just pile them on top of each other. If I, for example, expect a heel to happen and I strap some restraint onto my dog and all I do now is punish everything that they do wrong and allow them the relief of no punishment when they do something correct, my friends, that is soul crushing on so many different levels. I am not teaching expression, I am teaching suppression. And that's not what we are here for. The flip side of that, since we are here for reinforcement-based training, is understanding the difference between chunking and successive approximation. What is chunking? Chunking is when I get my student to do the whole thing. I said, sit, sit. Why weren't you born with an understanding of English? Sit, sit, sit. I'm expecting them to sit. And eventually, especially as puppies, they go, dude, you're really meaning whatever it is you're saying. And they're going to give you some attention. They're also going to give you some deference because they're puppies and they will actually sit. And you'll go, yes, have some food. And then you'll repeat the whole thing. But what you're asking them to do is the whole sit. Break it down. Make it easy for your puppy to understand. Make it easy for your new dog to understand. Hey, here's some food. Do you want it? Build a game up. Make it interesting. Get them to follow the food around. Stage zero learning is all about, hey, come and get it. Follow this food around. Can you follow food from one hand to the next and back again? Can you do spins? Can you do circles? Can you stretch your neck up? Can you stretch your neck to the side? If I hold your chest back, will you push against it to try and get the food? Building up a desire, a healthy desire for the reinforcer. We haven't even begun the sit. Look at all those things that I've just taught the student in order for them just to be able to sit. So from there then, if I've got a neck stretch, then I can actually move that lure up and over my dog's head as if I'm going from their nose up to their forehead and they have to stretch, but physiology kind of dictates that I can only stretch so far, and in order to stretch my head and reach my head further up as a dog, I actually have to park my butt. And as soon as they start to dip their hips, click, food. Then I wait for a little bit more. They get into that half squat, click, feed. Now all of a sudden, they're happily going into that half squat and then their butt actually hits the floor, click, major jackpot, done. And then in the next session, I can go, hey, we did a sit last time. That's now the minimum benchmark. Let's go. Let's see where we can end up. And from there, I can start to build up a stay. From there, I can start to put a name to it. From there, I can start to introduce distractions. I can start to really do cool things like go out of sight and have my puppy sit, have my dog sit. Successive approximation is a surefire way to avoid soul-crushing obedience. But this is really important. If I take those steps too small and I sit on those steps for too long, I will equally crush my student's soul. Because whilst a predatory animal like a dog is able to solve problems, particularly through their predatory mindset, if I make things too easy, too stagnant, or if I don't pay commensurate to the effort that they're putting in, my student will betray my actions openly and visibly for everyone. They will suck. So it is important for me to make sure that I advance my skill set as fast as I can, challenging my student each step of the way. They're a predator. They're built to be challenged. Another couple of ways, which is really cool, is in how we chain things together. I might have a series of different skills that I might need to call upon in a very specific way. So I might start with the end in mind. So for example, if I want my dog to place at the end of a routine, I might just teach that place or that pedestal first, build some value into that, keeping in mind that the value of the TAM flows into the behavior that I'm teaching. But then if I have my end goal, that is super valuable, and then I teach them the step just prior to that, that takes on value, then the next one. So what's happening then is as I teach something new or I insert a new link into that chain, my student then learns, sit through this, I'll get some external reinforcement, but as we progress to the next bit, I already feel good. I know what's coming. I can predict it. I know what it's like. I can do this. And as we graduate through the chain of behaviors, getting back to that place, then our student is able to take some agency and they're constantly looking forward to getting to that end goal. The reverse of that can also be true, where we do forward chaining, where I might need to work from the beginning of a chain of events, work my way forwards, because you might have whatever task it is, it doesn't really matter. But if I have start my dog in a sit, that takes on the value of the TAM, but then the next step in the chain doesn't have value, I will need to artificially inject some value into that, and that's why I've got the clicker, that's why I've got the whistle, that's why I've got my TAM at my disposal. Now here's something that a lot of pros use, is a concept called power-ups. And in stage zero learning, we do this all the time. Spins and circles, hand touches, all sorts of cool stuff. Spins and circles are fantastic. Getting your student to be able to spin clockwise and anti-clockwise. Think of it this way. If I have spent my entire student's life teaching them how to do this disposable behavior. No one cares how many times they can spin, but if I can just give them a hand signal or tell them to spin and they spin, it doesn't need to be super reliable. It's fun, and that's the whole point of it. So if I'm doing a really complicated heel routine, for example, I'm heeling past some distractions and I'm like, dude, the grind here is really starting to get to my dog. I can see that the enthusiasm is starting to diminish. I can suddenly call in for a circle and my student spins counterclockwise. Perfect. My student's at my left side. They spin away from me, come back into heel position. I can do that a couple of times. All of a sudden, the dopamine and all the other feel-good hormones start to fire from my dog's brain. The grind is forgotten. Soul crushing is avoided. And we can soldier on with the next bunch of repetitions. Power-ups are a really great way of just having fun with your student whilst keeping them within a tighter constraint of that repetition. Lastly, play. Play with your dog. Pat them, praise them, rough play, wrestle with them, throw a ball, play tug, whatever games it is that they like to do, run away from them, let them chase you, chase them, do all sorts of cool things with them. Do them once you've done a whole bunch of repetitions, give them some rest. Ever heard of zoomies? I don't see that in my sessions. Why don't I see that in my sessions? Because I break it up. Allow your student to feel the performance and get the pride of what is happening in that performance. Allow them the independent expression to be able to be themselves. And then once that session is done or you've done a bunch of repetitions, break up into a play session and just let them explode a little bit. Do it with you as part of a team. Through that, you're avoiding all of the soul-crushing experiences that affect most dogs. And most dogs that I see, they cannot respond in a heightened situation. Why? Because soul-crushing events don't happen in high-intensity situations, generally speaking. There's more to that to follow in another episode. But when I'm teaching a skill, when I'm training a skill, when I'm testing a skill, when I'm trialing a skill, none of that is soul-crushing. That's not the point of an expressive, enthusiastic, laden with effort, well-performing student. Here's the hardest one. The hardest one is patience. Can you withstand the amount of mistakes your student's gonna make? Dude, I really, really hope so. Why? Because successes are just the tip of the iceberg. And a lot of people want you to think successes is all gotta be about successes. It doesn't. What's underneath the waves is a mountain of failure on your behalf, on your students' behalf. And guess what? It doesn't matter. Failure is a part of learning. Being patient and allowing your student to make mistakes, to self-discover them, to be supported away from those mistakes. That's why we have those markers. To be able to highlight errors, to be able to highlight good execution. That is important. And for you to have patience, 15 to 24 months is a long time. It's okay if they don't sit on command for a little while. It's okay if your heel is shaky. Don't worry about it. Be patient. This is a long-term thing. When you send your kid to early childcare, you should have the HSC in their mind. You should have a university degree in your mind. You should be pushing your kid from the moment they get into early childcare. You should be developing them to be the best that they can be, no? If you disagree, let me know. But I also happen to believe that you should be doing the same thing with your canine. Your students need that from you, a level of expectation. But that comes with a certain amount of patience as well. So I hope that your takeaway is to be patient, to play with your dog, to make things easier for your student to be able to understand that there are two different ways that you can get towards the end goal, forward chaining, backward chaining. I want you to be able to understand that successive approximation is an amazing thing, and be above and beyond all, use markers, use things, sounds, visuals, I don't care what it is, but use something that you can teach your dog. There's a concept behind this, like a clicker. Fantastic tool for avoiding soul-crushing obedience and anything else you teach. Thank you so much for hanging around. I know that time is really valuable. I'm trying to keep this really short for you. If you're affected by any of this, please do let me know. If you've got any questions about this, please do ask me. You can come into the Barefoot Paws discussion group on Facebook. Alternatively, you can get into direct contact with me at admin@barefootpaws.com.au. You can get in touch with me through the website at barefootpaws.com.au. You can also visit me on social media, on Instagram and Facebook. Please, I would love to hear back from you. I hope that you got some good takeaways from this. I'll see you in the next episode.